Welcome to The Front Porch, where we discuss the issues that are affecting Appalachia and West Virginia in specific. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director here. I'm joined by Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
And Lori Lynn from the Charleston Daily Mail. Hey, Lori.
Hi, Scott.
And today we talk about the plight of working class men in America and in our region. It is no longer easy. Your job prospects are much bleaker than they were a generation ago. And what does that do to both our society and our culture? Laura, you've been looking into this from a national perspective. What have you found?
This was the most striking statistic that I found. Between 1979 and 2013, real wages for men, for blue-collar men with just a high school degree, were down 21%. For women with the same amount of education, they were actually up a little bit, 3%. So when you look at the decline of the prospects of people with a high school degree since the 1970s, it's all coming from men. They're paying the price for it, not women, really.
And is there any data about why that's happening? Why is it the men are the ones that are losing ground?
I think it's the type of jobs. You know, you look at mining, construction jobs, there are fewer of those. The jobs that we have more of now are jobs, you know, jobs for, again, for people with high school degrees, are healthcare jobs. Many of them pay, you know, reasonably well. And, you know, when you go to the hospital, they're women. They're women who are doing those jobs.
Rick, you talked about growing up in this region and how different it is for men looking for jobs now. What's different?
The thing that I remember as a kid, that you had a pretty good chance of getting a job at a place in, say, in Huntington or Charleston, that had decent wages, like Union Carbide, like Steel of West Virginia, American Car and Foundry. There were a lot of manufacturing jobs, typically unionized, that paid a good wage, had good benefits. We did a study that looked back 30-some years, and in the late 70s, West Virginia actually had higher than average wages, pension coverage, health insurance, and again, it's because there were those jobs. And then it was overdetermined. I think we got hit by several different things, the globalization of the economy, the mechanization of mines. I remember coming of age at a time when the traditional ladders that working class men could climb out of just weren't there anymore. My first real job was a janitor in a public library. There wasn't any factories for me.
I used to live, as I said before, in a place called Big Ugly Creek in Lincoln County. And a lot of the men at the time, this was the early 90s, were in the coal mines. I was a Vista volunteer. And I remember I had this really great volunteer who had to leave the after-school program, and always did, at about 4:15 every day, because she had to get home and get dinner on the table for her husband when he got back from the mines. It was non-negotiable. It didn't matter what was going on. It didn't matter that, you know, there might be an event to plan for that night. It didn't matter that her son may want to stick around a little bit later in the after-school program. What does it do to a family when that breadwinner, which is happening 11,000 times across West Virginia, these coal miners losing their jobs, what's happening to those 11,000 families who may have some of these same traditional relationships? What does that do to the family dynamics?
It's hard on the woman, you know. I mean, I can't imagine. And it's, you know, the studies are always saying that even in marriages where women work, you know, just as many hours as the men, the woman often bears the bigger responsibility as far as, you know, child rearing and laundry and cooking and things at home. So, yeah, when the husband loses his job, then everything is thrown out of whack.
I mean, he really loses his sense of identity, even more so than a woman who might lose her job in this sort of traditional society, right? Or am I being sexist by saying that?
I mean, I think traditionally men are raised to do things, to be out there, to, you know, are socialized to be the one who goes out to be the breadwinner. And when that doesn't happen anymore, when that's no longer possible, I think it really is a shock. There's a sociology term that I think is really useful, that it's called anomy. It comes from the Greek word nomos, or law. It's like when things change and the old rules don't apply anymore, it's really hard to get by, and it can really be devastating. I remember, I don't have all the statistics. There's a book in the 80s on the deindustrialization of America. And it looked at, you know, for every increase of unemployment sustained over a six-month period, there are all these increases in other problems, whether it would be crime or admission to, you know, emergency rooms or substance abuse or other kind of things like that, because it really disrupts the whole course of a life. And people have to figure out who they are and how to get by in a radically changed circumstance.
I believe the Pope just had a quote the other day that where there is no work, there is no dignity.
Let me flip it around, though. So especially in a place like Appalachia, changing mores and changing attitudes, it's hard on people and scary. On the other hand, isn't this long overdue? There's other data that shows that women for years and years in our region have gotten paid less for doing the same work than men, that the pay gap is worse here between men and women than in other parts of the country. I mean, maybe it's time that women take more power in the workplace and in the family. Is there a silver lining to all this?
Yeah, one question that I would ask, I kept seeing how it affects women when men are not working, when men don't have great prospects. For example, in the African American community, a lot of women complain there aren't enough men who are, you know, not in prison, who have good jobs, and you know, we want to get married, and there aren't men there. And I think it's sort of unbalanced in the sense that you don't hear men complaining, oh, there aren't enough women with good jobs. It's that there's still that kind of, I think, you know, you ask people what's desirable in a mate, and for women, earning potential is up pretty high. For men, that's on the list, but they're not as concerned about that.
Well, what I find fascinating is, and this is happening in the white community, just like in minority communities, is the decoupling in the working class between marriage and childbearing. And the idea that I want to have a kid, I don't want to wait to do that, but there's not a marriageable man to do it, so I'll live with somebody and have a kid, and then maybe if he gets his act together or gets a job or whatever, then maybe we'll get married later. What's the effect of that decoupling of marriage and childbearing on families?
I mean, I think it can have potentially a huge effect. I mean, I've read there are all these studies that suggest that married people are happier than single people as a rule, which makes me think single people must be really miserable. Good thing my wife doesn't listen to the show.
I'll email her that clip, Rick.
Actually, I think if you break down the data, I think actually men tend to live longer if they're married. I think women do fine better without men than men do without women.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's no one to cook the dinner, right?
Yeah, well, like, look at
or make sure you go to the doctor. I mean, really, that's a lot of it.
Yeah.
All right, like American history, I think it's really interesting. Look at the difference between Jamestown and Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, they came over in fairly intact family groups, and they were much more stable and stuff. And in Jamestown, you had a bunch of sort of wastrels who would like throw deer carcasses into the drinking water. And
it's the frat house problem.
The frat house problem. Yeah, like my wife's been out of town for a couple of weeks. Like, oh my God, she's coming back. Oh God, it's going to be a nightmare just getting things back up to snuff. So, you know, there's that factor there. You know.
Well, and Rick, you were talking about the study that you guys did that just shows the shift that the biggest employer of West Virginia is no longer Weirton Steel, right? It is
Walmart. And thereby hangs a tale. I mean, think about the job quality, the wages, the benefits. And, I mean, you could say the advantage of a Walmart economy is you can buy a lot of things cheaply there. And that's true. But the things that the really big ticket items like housing, healthcare, higher education, those haven't gotten cheaper. Yeah, you can buy a really fairly cheap DVD player, but college, not so much. So those are all factors I think are part of a pinch.
Is this a myth in my head? The idea that men who used to work in high-paying jobs in construction in the coal mines are not willing to take significant pay cuts to work in service jobs.
I haven't read a study of that, but if you look, you know, coal mining jobs pay actually really, really well, especially, you know, considering the education that they require. And so it makes sense that if you're laid off from that, from, say, a $70,000, $80,000 a year job, and your alternative is to take a job at, say, Walmart, where you're going to be making a fraction of that, it just doesn't work. You can't pay your mortgage. It's kind of unthinkable.
So it's better to be unemployed? I mean, that's...
Well, you can collect unemployment for a while. Hmm. Your wife can go to work. I mean, you could take two jobs, which some people do, which is, you know, has its own toll on your family and your life.
Let me ask some questions about your family work-life balance, everybody here. What percentage of the household chores do you do versus your significant other? And I'll start. And Wendy does listen to this, so I have to be honest, like truly honest.
Oh.
And we make about the same, right? We both have full professional lives. And yet I would say she does 65% of the stuff in the house. She does anything that requires thinking, like paying bills. I'm there for waste removal and some fixing stuff, although Not enough to make up for the fact that I don't do much else. I take care of the kids some too.
But is some of that, I mean, would you say that she has a higher standard than you do? I mean, there was a piece, I think, in the Atlantic or some magazine a few years ago where the husband is just saying, you know, I don't care if the house is spotless, and she does, so of course she is going to be, I mean, it's a stereotype, but I think it is grounded in reality for a lot of people.
I love that you're making this argument on my behalf. I will say, though, my standard is pretty abysmally low. I mean, like health department level.
So it's not an excuse, then.
No, she's not. She doesn't have unreasonable standards, okay. No.
Well, you know, I suffer from male pattern blindness. You know what I mean? Like a lot of things that just don't rise to my threshold or I don't see. It's like the question I dread is, do you like what I've done? It's like, I didn't know there was going to be a quiz, you know? So, yeah.
That's great, honey.
The answer's always yes.
It's like, I mean, if the roof was gone, I'd probably notice that, you know, or something. But I mean, I try to do my share. And I think I gave most of my kids their baths when they were little, when they were growing up and things, and really tried to be engaged because that's something I grew up without, and I really wanted to compensate for that. And it's funny, my daughter is totally opposite. My son is the domestic one. My daughter is like this prima donna, you know, running around, overachiever, you know, running ultra marathons and doing karate tournaments. Here's one thing to think about, that how we're socialized, and it might actually be more than socialization. Men have traditionally been socialized through separation. You know, you go out and make your way in the world, and women and girls have traditionally been socialized more for relationships, relationally and things. And it even affects how bad behavior among boys and girls. Like a bully guy will like push around someone else. Bully girls will punish through relationships and things. And I don't know, I'm thinking back over the last year, how many times both my daughter and my wife have said to me, use your words. I mean, I can use them when I'm working or writing and stuff, but like,
so the way we raise boys might not be, and this affects you as someone who's raising two, Lori, maybe it's not the most effective way to prepare them for the world that we're in today. If you teach at the college level in particular, you're seeing more and more women succeeding and getting degrees and coming out into the workforce. So there's this vast middle of very successful women, and yet you have on the top echelons of society still dominated by men, especially right. In West Virginia. Only a handful of women in the state legislature, for example.
Sociologist James Q. Wilson says there are more male geniuses and more male idiots. So there's more men at both ends of the bell curve.
Well, folks, what can we do to deal with the fact that we have all these working class men right now that are unemployed and underemployed? And then also, how can we prepare into the next generation of boys to grow into the men that are ready to take the jobs of the future?
I think, Rick, the easiest thing is the next generation. I mean, there's a lot of research, and I hope we talk about it in one of our future episodes, about early childhood education, which ideally would begin when the child is still in the womb with home visiting, to make sure that there's good nutrition, that people know about smoking and drinking, the problems there, and to check on maternal health, and to make sure that it's never too young to start talking and singing and reading to a child, and to notice the developmental things like that. I mean, that's one thing I think that clearly works and has been sort of proven to save money. That's the easiest part of it.
I think another thing to look at is how we approach people who are unemployed, because I think studies show that men and women deal with that very differently. Men are more likely to isolate themselves, and it's actually easier to isolate yourself nowadays because you have the internet, so you can sit at home, you get your social interaction, you can even date people you meet through the internet. And women are much less likely to kind of retreat into themselves. They're more likely to keep their social networks. And that makes it easier for them to then get out into the world and get a new job.
I think it's a fascinating point, because every good job that I've ever gotten, every single one of them happened because of a connection I had with somebody else.
Another piece of it, I think we really need to work. It's a huge challenge now to do that kind of workforce training and development to help people match up for the jobs. And they really get innovative about what kind of jobs there could be, since we're going through a transition now and how we can get there. And the other thing I think it's good to remember is that we talk about men and women and boys and girls. It's not like they're competitive teams. I mean, a certain group of men can be having a really bad time, and it's not that a certain group of women are saying, ha ha, we got you guys. It's not, you know, there's right. Separate things. You know, women can have something going on, and men can have something going on. It's not like a zero-sum game where they're taking it from each other. I think there are a lot of challenges out there today.
Yeah, and our discussion of the wage gap, I think, so often takes on that tone of, you know, kind of women versus men, and I think that's really counterproductive.
One final thing. If masculinity no longer means being the person that goes out and is the breadwinner for the family, if that's no longer the main definition, then what is it?
There's a Spanish word that I like called el poder, which you could say it's power, but it means to be able to do something. And so I think it's good to rethink about what power is, power over yourself, some degree of control over your life, power that you have with other people democratically, not necessarily power over. And the other thing I think is good for guys, like I work in it typically in a lot of fields where there's women and men, but you know, I love hanging out when I was on the fire department, just hanging out. And there were women there too, but just hanging out with the boys and talking trash and insulting each other, you know, or hanging out at the karate dojo where we're just merciless to each other. We beat each other up, but we love each other and things like that. I mean, I think it's good to have spaces like that that include women too, who can stand it, you know, it's, you know, some kind of spaces where you can get your jollies out like that.
And another thing we can do is, you know, the definition of masculinity may be changing, but let's not do away with the notion of fatherhood, of fathers as, you know, special people distinct from mothers that have, you know, special relationships with their kids. Studies show that boys who grow up without fathers do worse than girls who grow up without fathers. So, you know, again, you have the boys actually need the fathers more. So let's not throw that out the window as we redefine masculinity.
Well, I do think that that's true. When my son is sick, you know, he calls out for his mom. But the other day when we were at the pool, he was looking to me to try to figure out ways to make it more interesting, to challenge himself. You know, I helped him to climb onto sort of a rickety ladder to get high up above the pool so he could jump in and challenge himself. Yep. And it took him a long time to do that. But when he did it, he felt so proud of himself. And his mother, who is hearing this right now, is probably going to be really furious at me. But I know that that's what he wanted. He wanted to be challenged and to take a risk and to overcome it. And I think that's what I bring to the equation.
Yep.
You know, a Greek mythology moment. You know, when Odysseus finally gets back home to Ithaca, the young men are acting horribly. You know, they're abusing his hospitality. They're acting up. And they don't know how to act because all their fathers went away to Troy to fight. And they grew up. I think there, you know, there is a value. There's a, even in societies that have a youth bulge, that means a whole lot of young people, not that many older people to mentor and sort of moderate things. So there is a real, I think, deeply rooted biological role for elders, you know, to be there among younger people and help them come up. And there are traditional, non-traditional male and female ways and other ways of doing that. So I think, and you want a biblical verse?
Sure.
What does the Lord require of the old man but that thou do justly, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God? Micah chapter 6.
But surely that doesn't only apply to men, right?
No, but it's the best I could do.
Women get a pass.
Yep.
All right, Lori Lynn, is there anything else you want to add to the conversation?
No.
How confident are you that your sons are going to, what's it going to look like, the relationship between men and women, when they start out another 15 years from now? What's going to be different?
Oh, gosh, I think about that so much, you know, and I think about it in terms of just dating. You know, what is dating going to be like when they're in their 20s? There are all these apps that you use, and, you know, it seems like nobody actually just meets a nice person at college. So I think about that a lot, actually. I have no idea, but I'm sure I'm going to be one of those people who says, oh, gosh, back in my day, it was so much easier, so much better. Look at you crazy kids.
All right.
I wanted my daughter to be real confident, and I wanted my son to be capable of self-doubt.
As a corrective? Almost?
Kind of, yeah.
Hmm.
I grew up in a family where my mom was, you know, very confident. She was very smart. She was a math teacher. I never once thought, for example, that girls weren't as smart as boys. I never confronted that, to be honest, until I got to law school and I looked around and most of my law professors were men. So I think I had it very good. And we try to ingrain that in our kids as, you know, mommy's smart too, even though she doesn't, you know, have a high powered legal job.
Well, let's talk about that because, you made the decision to take your career down. How can I say it? To take your career down to nothing. Now look at you here. The lowest you could possibly get. What I meant to say, Lori, is you made a decision to kind of downshift in your career so you could spend more time with your boys. And your husband was the one that kept the full-time job. And describe that conversation. How did you guys come to that as a family?
Yeah, well, we, I think we both grew up in families where our moms, you know, didn't work. At least, you know, my mom went back to work when my younger sibling got, you know, into elementary school. But we were just very comfortable with having one of us be at home with the kids when they were very small. And I wanted to do it. You know, I was a corporate tax lawyer for 5 years, and I never thought that that was going to be my be-all and end-all career. And so, you know, when my first son was born, I couldn't have imagined not staying home with him, and I was very fortunate that I had that opportunity. So, you know, for me, it's been a choice, and it's been a choice that I know that I'm very, very lucky to have.
So feminism.
That was a choice that a lot of working class West Virginians had, you know, and that we've lost over the last several decades.
Yeah, and that's kind of sad, isn't it? Because what you want is for people to make, like you did, Lori, to make the decision about which parent gets to stay home and how much they stay home. And, yeah, for a lot of working class folks, they don't get to make those decisions. They're made for them. Yeah.
Oh, a lot of women would much prefer to be, you know, they would rather not be working at Walmart. They'd rather be at home with their kids, but they don't have that choice.
Right. And it's kind of a safety net to have one parent not in the workforce so they can step up if something does happen. And again, that's something we've lost. A lot of people have lost.
So I'm going to tell a story about a family without necessarily naming names. But I think it's really difficult and sad when the father is laid off and the mother has a good job, but the father isn't entirely wanting to step into that role of being the caregiver. And you end up in a really nasty situation where, and I've seen it happen, where the father, you know, is doing a half-assed job of raising the kids and taking care of them. It's almost like the mother is still single mother, having to work and having to do all of that. And then the resentment that comes from looking at your spouse and saying, you're at home, why aren't you picking up more of the slack? And that doesn't speak very well for those men, I think, although maybe I should be more sympathetic to psychologically what's going on.
Well, and culturally, you know, I think a lot of men just aren't conditioned to think of that as manly work, as work that's, you know, that they're even good at. And sometimes we as women undermine that, you know, every time you say to your husband, you're not doing it right, you're not bathing him right, you know. I think you have to be careful about that.
What's interesting, is that happening because the woman may feel like they ought to be doing it and they're not?
Yeah, so I think there is some of that, that the woman should just be kind of the one who intrinsically knows how to take care of the kids and, you know, which way to do the laundry. And, you know, I try to be very careful about that. I'm just so happy that he's bathing the kids every night, because that's my least favorite parenting activity. I would never criticize the manner in which he did it.
Comes back to anime. Am I saying that right?
Anime, yeah.
No, anime is a...
Anime is the Japanese cartoon.
Yeah. Interesting. I wasn't quite sure where you're going with this.
It all comes back to Japanese animation. No, anime, this idea of living in a world where everything's changed and yet you're still hardwired through maybe your biology, definitely your cultural upbringing, to think of things a certain way. And we're all struggling through that. It's exciting and scary all at the same time.
I mean, it is a concern that a lot of people aren't marriageable because they're over-incarcerated or they're not in the workforce. And I think that sort of undermines stable families. And I think there is a lot to be said for having stable families. So.
Right. Or even if they're not in prison, but they've gotten out of prison and can't get a job because they have a record, that's a huge problem.
Yep.
I'm a big fan of women lowering their standards.
Oh, yeah.
It worked
for
me.
Yeah, me too.
So, you know, I'm hoping I can put that out there.
There you have it.
You've been listening to The Front Porch. I don't know why, but you have been. And I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, joined by Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee.
Thanks, Scott.
And thank you. And Lori Lynn of the Charleston Daily Mail.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.